did. I just turned on the recorder. The last chunk of this is the last phrase, which is Prince of Peace. So we've done Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. And the Prince of Peace is the one that I think of all of those is most common. You know, we talk about Jesus as Prince of Peace, not only within the context, excuse me, of this particular verse, but outside of it as well. And I'm going to start by reading quite a long chunk from Walter Brueggemann's book, because he describes something that I think is very interesting, and he just does it very well, and I don't want to paraphrase him for you. So settle in for a minute, and I'll read, and then we can talk about it.
What page are you reading
from? What page am I reading from? 52.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And the headline of this section is Peace as an Ambiguous Political Chant. So if you have that kind of in your head.
Could you repeat that?
Peace as an Ambiguous Political Chant. It is important to recognize at the outset that the term peace in Prince of Peace is the word shalom that describes not only an absence of hostility, but the maintenance of a prosperous social system, so that the intent is something like promote the general welfare. Note that in Jeremiah 29:7 and 11, we commonly translate shalom as welfare. Perhaps the quintessential king of peace in the Old Testament is Solomon, for his very name is a play on shalom, as is the royal city over which he presided, Jerusalem. It is clear, however, that Solomon's policies depended on heavy armaments as well as cheap labor that reflected a willingly coercive policy antithetical to social welfare. It is for such reasons that at his death there was open rebellion against and resistance towards such heavy-handed governments. Indeed, it turns out that the name Solomon is ironic, for his policies precluded any serious chance for genuine shalom in his reign. The ambiguity of Solomon's practice of, quote, peace, unquote, is quite at variance from the liturgically imagined shalom of Psalm 71, or 72. Hi, Donna. And this is a quote from Psalm 72. May the mountains yield prosperity for the people, and the hills in righteousness. In his days may righteousness flourish, and peace abound until the moon is no more. Here in ancient Israel's liturgic imagination, the premise of peace is the practice of justice for the poor and needy, and that anticipated peace includes a more general prosperity for the people, that is, not just for the urban elites clustered around the king. In this anticipation, there is none of the coercion of exploitative policies that marked the actual practice of Solomon. The same ambiguity about peace is reflected in the awaited disarmament that is a prerequisite for shalom. Clearly, as long as there are armaments, peace will be at most a restless, unstable possibility. And indeed, the Old Testament anticipates disarmament as a prelude to peace. But disarmament is equally ambiguous. In the prophetic oracles that are familiar to us, Isaiah 2:1-4 and Micah 4:1-5, disarmament is freely undertaken. In response to Torah instruction, those who hold arms will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, and they shall not learn war anymore. Elsewhere, however, disarmament is itself coercive activity enforced by the victor who eliminates the arms of the losing adversary. Thus, in the Isaiah oracle to which we have been appealing, disarmament is an act of violent imposition. The weapons of the defeated are burned in a dramatic way, and he quotes Isaiah 9:5. For all the boots of the trampling warriors and all the garments rolled in blood shall be burned as a fuel for the fire. And since this is in the oracle that anticipates the king as Prince of Peace, It is likely that the anticipated Prince of Peace will be a victor who can impose disarmament on his adversaries. In the same anticipation is voiced in Psalm 46, a song that celebrates Jerusalem and declares that God will end war. And the quote is, "He makes wars to cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear and burns the shields with fire." So I'm going to stop there for a minute because he kind of pulls two things together. The concept of shalom as encompassing not just the absence of warfare, but the general welfare of the people, and the idea that that can only really be accomplished through disarmament. And as I was reading that, it struck me that it has very strong resonances for our day. You know, one of the chants that from the 60s through to today that people chant is "no justice, no peace," right? That there won't be peace until there is justice. But also how much of our current gross national product goes into defense spending that could be spent on general welfare if we weren't spending it on tanks and bombs. And again, that's, you know, I remember when I was in college, one of the signs we had in the education department said, you know, "Wouldn't it be great if the schools had all the money they needed and the defense department had to hold a bake sale to buy a bomber?"
Oh, that's great.
So, you know, those two concepts of peace encompassing the general welfare and disarmament being a prerequisite both for the absence of war, but also for that general welfare, I think really continues to speak today. So I'll stop now and let you guys reflect.
How can you have disarmament, though, when you might have enemies that are going to overpower you and take you over? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the purpose of the military, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's defense, not aggression.
It depends on how you view it. You know, if you look at the United States, we've been invaded exactly once at Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, well, that's not exactly true. We were also invaded from Canada a little bit during the War of 1812. But you know, do we need as large an army as we have to actually defend ourselves? So, you know, that's the counter argument. I'm sorry?
Unknown, really, because we really don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you get China and Russia, those are two big countries that could do a lot of damage if we didn't have a big defense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and especially with intercontinental missiles now, mm-hmm. it could destroy the U.S. from China, mm-hmm. for example,
mm-hmm.
and North Korea. That's what they're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's what their research is pursuing.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, we're doing research on the defensive so we can shoot the missiles out of the air before they land.
Mm-hmm. And that is actually the way that we took down the Soviet Union was by getting them to invest in research to counter our research, and it decimated their economy. And that brought down the Soviet Union. That's what ended the Cold War, was enticing them to overspend on their military. It wasn't our military that brought them down. It was enticing them to invest so much in defensive research that they couldn't maintain their society. So there is a tipping point there, and, you know, so, you know, I thought that was interesting. And the idea that shalom, the word that we translate as peace, doesn't only mean the absence of war. So, did anybody else? The other piece I don't want to lose about that is that peace assumes justice, especially for the poor and needy, as well as general prosperity. That idea of no justice, no peace is not modern. It's biblical. That there can't be peace if the poor and needy are not treated with justice.
But in our current situation, justice, the critical justice being in the forefront right now is racial mm-hmm. justice.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Not just financial, but racial as well.
Right.
Just to throw a little monkey wrench in here, mm-hmm. what about man's sort of inherent leaning toward greed?
So if you talk...
To assume that peace will bring prosperity for all,
mm-hmm.
I think is a little naive.
Mm-hmm.
I really do.
I
don't think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
I'm not opposed to that, but I just think it's kind of naive because even with the experiment, for example, with communism, mm-hmm. which was started on the basis of, you know, let's share the wealth with everyone. No one should have extra. It didn't
mm-hmm.
work.
Mm-hmm.
It did not work. I mean, mm-hmm. the people, there was corruption, there was greed.
Mm-hmm.
People had more. Some people had more than others.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how... I think all of these things are philosophically wonderful
mm-hmm.
ideas. In reality, because of the nature of man, I'm
mm-hmm.
not sure that they are workable.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not for spending a gazillion dollars on defense
mm-hmm.
either, but the research that we have and the kind of weaponry that comes out of the research is kind of what holds things in balance, not necessarily in this day and age huge armies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I don't think the huge armies will play
mm-hmm.
if we ever release biological warfare
yeah.
or nuclear warfare. It doesn't matter how many tanks you have, or
mm-hmm.
it'll just finish it right there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But
well,
I just wonder. I like the idea of peace and prosperity for all. I think it's a wonderful thing. I just don't know if it's real. The nature of man being what it is.
Mm-hmm. I do wonder, I think Brueggemann's point is it isn't that peace brings prosperity, it's that prosperity brings peace.
Okay.
And if you think about that, if you look back at the history of our country...
Yeah, I think it can bring internal peace.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, within our own nation.
Right.
I do think that justice and fairness is always been
mm-hmm.
a major, you know... a major point of,
mm-hmm.
you know, angst and difficulty for people. And in terms of fairness and in terms of religion and, you know, in our religious beliefs, it's every service, it's, you know, remember the poor,
mm-hmm.
The widow, the sojourner,
mm-hmm.
the, you know,
yep.
the things from the Bible and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a... you know, it's a good message. I'm just wondering how it's taken 2,000 years
mm-hmm.
for us to get it
mm-hmm.
as a people.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's what I mean. I mean, to get the idea that it maybe is the right path to take, you know. We don't have it. You're absolutely right.
Right. Well, and of course, remember... Yeah. Remember when we talk about Jesus as this king, and we talk about the kingdom of God, which we're doing in Advent, we're talking about two kinds of things, right? I preach this a lot, but it's still a tough concept, that the kingdom of God is already and not yet,
mm-hmm.
that God's kingdom is here today, and it is our job to build it and make it happen, but that it won't be completed in this time. It will take the return of Jesus to bring it completely. So we build bits of it, and it's completed when Jesus comes. And I, you know, I think a piece of that is that in the actual presence of God, it's hard to be greedy, right? When you're, if you're standing aware of the presence of God with you, it's hard to claim.
I think it would be hard.
Yeah. If only because God would look at you, right?
You know, human.
And so, you know, when we talk about imagining ourselves in the presence of God, the goal is to try to remember that. But it's not quite the same as, you know, when Jesus is standing in front of you saying, do you really need that? That will be a different, you know. It's like with your kids when you're trying to teach them, you know, the difference between needs and wants. And
yes. Yeah, I mean, one of the hardest ideas in the Bible is to just give away everything and mm-hmm. follow me.
You know, I think that's hard. I think the hardest idea in the Bible is the one of the parable of the workers in the vineyard, where the workers who work all day get the same as the workers who work 2 hours.
Oh, that's true.
And God says, are you angry because I'm generous? You know, it's like, well, yes, actually, thank
yes,
you.
Yes, I am. Sam busted my traps all day.
Yeah. I struggle with that one a lot more.
You know, I don't know.
Because, you know, giving away all you have, that's a choice.
You know, we strive and we never make it. And our society has come a long way mm-hmm. over the millennia mm-hmm. in terms of how people are treated generally. Mm-hmm. The poor, for example, like we have social programs; they're mm-hmm. not adequate. We mm-hmm. have, but there's, you know, you're not just slapped in the poorhouse and let them die, you know, kind mm-hmm. of thing. Same with medical issues and medical care and care.
But we still have work to do.
Mm-hmm. Much work, absolutely. I mean, it's better. It's not great. Not if you're on the low end of the stick. There's no mm-hmm. question about it. You know.
Yeah.
I heard a lady today on the news, just very briefly. I didn't catch the whole story. And apparently, she doesn't have the money for mm-hmm. her house.
Mm-hmm.
And they're about to foreclose. I guess. And mm-hmm. she's desperate to try to keep her house. And the statement that really tugged at my heart when she said, I've never had any security in my life
mm-hmm.
except for this house.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And you think about that'll reduce you to tears when you really think about it. That for those of us who are fortunate enough to be where we are,
mm-hmm.
and I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, your house gone, your place to live, what do you... And it's true for all the homeless and the...
Mm-hmm. You know, they're talking right now, and it is true, about a K-shaped recovery, where the people who are educated and able to work from home and continue to have jobs are actually doing okay in the midst of the pandemic, and the people who can't are really doing much worse.
Absolutely.
And so there, we are really seeing the division grow. If you think about the spokes of a K, you know, there was already division between the top and the bottom in our society, and it's getting worse.
Getting a different, No, that's absolutely true. I know in my family, mm-hmm. most of my nieces, nephews have been pretty much unaffected by this, except for the inconvenience, but... Mm-hmm. Financially, they are able to work at home. They have jobs that mm-hmm. allow them to work through the computer.
Mm-hmm.
Some are tradespeople. Like my great nephew's a plumber, for mm-hmm. example. He's still needed. You know, they're essential.
Mm-hmm.
Gotta have plumbing.
That's right.
So, no, it's really, and I, the huge tragedy of this for me has been the politics.
Mm-hmm.
The damn Democrats and the damn Republicans can't get their act together to put some kind of bill out there mm-hmm. to help these people. And let the pork drop by the wayside, and let's just focus on getting money to people who are in such critical condition. Mm-hmm. And I just am really disillusioned completely with not just, I don't blame anyone in particular, it's a Congress. Mm-hmm. That's everybody. Mm-hmm. That's all the political parties. And, you know, the Dems all out for a larger package, the Republicans for, pass something. Yeah. Get something to these people and then argue this out later. Those poor folks have been hanging for months mm-hmm. now since the first, mm-hmm. you know, the first pass. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
I don't think that was a reasonable action that they took to give everybody money.
Yeah. You know, you look at what Canada did, and the first stimulus thing they did went to everybody. But then, you only got money if you lost your job. But if you'd lost your job, you got 80% of what you used. I mean, they calculated it. 80% of what you made, they sent you.
Exactly.
Figuring that your expenses might be down a little bit.
Right.
You know. But if you had your job, you didn't get anything because you have a job. So.
Right. Exactly, you know? And I think it's foolish that mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And I had a father who, at the age of 65, was called in and said that by Social Security. They said, "Well, mm-hmm. you're supposed to take your Social Security now, Mr. Mm-hmm. Levy." And he said, "I don't need it. I'm still working."
Mm-hmm.
And they said, "Well, you have to take it."
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't. He said, "Well, why? If I don't need it?" And so what he did, he took his Social Security and he donated it all to people. He never used any of his Social Security mm-hmm. until he retired and he mm-hmm. could no longer work. Mm-hmm. Then he used it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, okay, there's a concept.
Yeah.
mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
It's admirable. It's really like he died in the role of Episcopalian, and yeah. he thought people needed it worse than he did. Got to share the wealth.
Yeah.
So see where my mind comes from. I had yeah. a father who did that radical thing.
My dad did that too when he was forced to take Social Security when he retired and didn't need it to live on. That was effectively his charitable giving for.
Exactly. And I did the same with my $1,200 yeah. that the government sent me.
Yeah.
Gave it away.
So, yeah, I have no patience with people who say, "Oh, it's too complicated to figure out how to just give it to people." I'm like, really, it's just math.
Not hard at all. Just write a check.
It's just math, and we have supercomputers right. who can do the math.
Right, right. You know? I mean, at a minimum, in our country, nobody should be hungry.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to draw this to a close, and I'm going to do it with. The last paragraph of Brueggemann's book, which I think draws this all together nicely. The Prince of Peace section, not the whole thing. But
right.
So, we are drawn to confess Jesus as Prince of Peace. We do so, however, in the awareness that this is no normal peace. The peace he brings is dangerous, subversive, and a contradiction of all that is usual. Advent is a freighted time in which to acknowledge that what we anticipate in the prophetic oracle of Isaiah deeply contradicts the expectation of ancient Israel. It deeply contradicts the expectation of those who trusted the Roman Empire, Jews and others. And it overrides the expectations of our society, which awaits a peacemaker who will ensure our advantage in the world. The Christ child who is born, coronated, and worshipped is innocent, but he is not innocuous. And I like that last line. The Christ child who is born, coronated, and worshipped is innocent, but he is not innocuous. That following Jesus as mighty God, everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, wonderful Counselor, makes us really look at our world and our society and our structures and how we are or are not conforming with who it is that God calls us to be. And that if we truly read the Gospels, they really are pretty subversive of empire. And as much as we don't want to admit it, maybe we would call the United States a hegemony rather than an empire. But we are a powerful nation, and we are citizens of a powerful nation. And so some of that subversiveness that Jesus proclaimed is aimed at our nation, as well as the Roman Empire. And so it is. These are lovely phrases, but they aren't just lovely. They are challenging. So, as you listen to recordings of the Messiah this Advent, hopefully it brings new insight.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
This is a bit off the topic, mm-hmm. but it just came to me during the service, mm-hmm. church service this morning, in the liturgy. In several places, the word name is uppercase,
mm-hmm.
and like in the Jubilate mm-hmm. and the mm-hmm. Confession of Sins,
mm-hmm.
They talk about, the name referring to God and mm-hmm. Jesus in uppercase M. Mm-hmm. Why is that done?
It's something that we pick up from Judaism that I think I've talked before about the Tetragrammaton, the four letters that are the name of God. Mm-hmm. In Judaism, those letters are always capitalized so that you know that it is the name. And sometimes you refer to God as the name or the one, and those would have been capitalized to show that we don't just mean any old name, we mean that particular name. And that practice, the writers of the Book of Common Prayer continued. So when we refer to the holy name of God, we capitalize name, even if we don't say the holy name of God, even if we just say the name of Jesus, mm-hmm. the Book of Common Prayer capitalizes it, and in our the liturgy we produce, we just pull it right over from the Book of Common Prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. You see that with one too sometimes, Jeanette, that one would be capitalized if we're talking about the one God.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to end this here. Just to remind you that the 14th, a week from Monday, we're going to be talking about the book Light of the World. And if you haven't gotten it and read it, you can still join the discussion. But if you're looking for something to read this December, it's really a fantastic book. It's short. It's about little vignettes from the Christmas story, so it's really appropriate for this time, and I think you'll really like it. She's a very good author, and it's both inspiring and calming in a way that maybe we need right now. So.
I have a question.
Sure.
If you could take another question.
Sure.
This kind of goes along with what you're just saying about that book, because mm-hmm. that's where this came from.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Magnificat and mm-hmm. Simeon's, mm-hmm. Those significant hymns or prayers or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There's a statement here that Luke incorporates, this is in a different book,
mm-hmm.
Luke incorporates in the story canticles taken from a collection of early hymns in Greek.
Mm-hmm.
And he refers to the Magnificat, the Benedictus,
mm-hmm.
The Glory in Excelsis, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So what does he mean by they're taken from a collection of early hymns in Greek?
Those are early songs that the early Christians would have used that were originally written in Greek, not in Hebrew.
Okay, but like, take the Magnificat
right.
for an example.
Yes.
The way I was reading this was that already existed prior to the Gabriel, the Annunciation of...
No, he's actually saying the opposite, that probably Mary didn't actually say those things. That probably those hymns were written after the resurrection, and Luke used them as he was compiling his gospel because it forwarded his message. So it's the opposite, that probably those particular hymns
pre-existed.
No. That probably those hymns did not exist at the time of the events that Luke's gospel is talking about, that they came to being afterwards, and he read them back into the story to help further his mission, which was to illustrate.
Who would have written the Magnificat?
Probably an early Christian, someone in Luke's gospel is put together in the 60s, 70s. So probably a Christian in the 40s or 50s. Maybe one of the people from Corinth or Ephesus that Paul's writing to. Somebody like that.
Okay, and the same thing would apply to the hymn or prayer of Simeon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And to the Gloria in Excelsis that Luke has the angels sing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Remember that for ancient writers, the reason you write a story isn't to record what actually happened, it's to teach a lesson.
Right.
So Luke would not have thought anything about that. He's like, oh yeah, this hymn that we are singing in our churches, that's what the angels would have sung. Of course it is, you know.
So there's a lot of symbolic value that he's taking advantage of.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And he's doing it intentionally because those are hymns that people might have been familiar with from singing in their, you know, in their churches, in their gatherings. So to put it in the story of Jesus, people are like, oh yes, I know that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So take your example of the Magi.
Mm-hmm.
Was there really a group of Gentiles that visited?
We don't know.
If there's any
historical
evidence of that?
There's no historical evidence of the birth of Jesus. And Matthew, remember that I've talked about this before, the Matthew and Luke stories don't actually fit together.
Right. Mm-hmm. They kind of predict each other.
They
right?
do, a lot. And we're so used to Christmas pageants and other things, you know, cramming them together and trying to make them fit, taking little bits from each of them, that we forget that nobody wrote about the birth of Jesus until 30 years after his death because it wasn't important. And that's the point, is that when Jesus was born, he wasn't
sometimes
important.
There's evidence of a thing occurring, but not necessarily exactly how.
No.
I mean, Jesus, there's evidence that he was real and he really existed. And so he had to have been born.
He had to have been born, but no, there's no...
And
certainly no records of astrologers coming from Persia to talk to King Herod. And actually, no. The one thing you thought might have made the records was the slaughter of the innocents in Bethlehem when Herod kills. But if you think about it, Bethlehem was a small village. So even killing all the children under two in that village, you're probably talking about maybe 10 children. And in that time, that just wasn't enough to make it into the records, the history, you know. You wouldn't report that to Rome because it wasn't a big enough deal.
Yeah, but if he was really concerned, and he was evil enough to have done that, because all the other atrocities he committed.
Yeah.
It's believable.
Yeah, it's believable because it's the kind of thing Herod would do.
Right.
But it wasn't a big enough thing to make it into records apart from the stories of Jesus. So did it happen? Maybe. Did Matthew make it up so that, because it kind of reflected who Herod was and it's the kind of thing he would have done and it fits with the prophecy about Rachel weeping for her children? Maybe, and does it really matter? You know.
But it's interesting to know what's symbolic and what's historical, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, there's very little of the life of Jesus that if you take out Christian writings, if you take out Paul and the Gospels and the, you know, if you take all those out, there's very little of the life of Jesus that could be independently confirmed. That's true about almost everybody. There's only a couple of references to Pontius Pilate in all of the Roman records. So we know he exists, there's maybe two references to him. So, then the same thing with Herod. There's more about Herod because Herod actually spent some time in Rome with the family of the emperor. And his children and grandchildren were raised in the emperor's household. So there's more records of him. But, yeah, not a lot. Okay. Well, I think that's a good place to stop. I'll see some of you on Monday and some of you on Wednesday for Bible study, and see you all next week for church.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Have a good week, everyone.
You too.